Our guest this morning is Lyle Muller. He's the Executive Director of the Board for Evangelism Services. He is a 1956 graduate of the best university in America, Valparaiso. And he's a 1961 graduate of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. He was born in Owatonna, Minnesota. I practiced that several times, I think. I hope I got close.
Owatonna,
Minnesota. And other services that he is rendering for our Synod right now, he's the chairperson of our Synod's Congregational Ministries Coordinating Committee. He is the editor of the Evangelgram, the Evangelism Newsletter, the yearly Friendship Celebration materials, and various Evangelism Bible studies and articles. He is the author and presenter of Evangelism Training Manuals, like the Witness Workshop, A Calling and Caring Ministry to Inactives, and Good News Day. He is the co-author and presenter of Pastor Witness Workshops. He's the co-author and editor of DE2, which is our Synod's Visitation Training Kit. He is the writer and editor and presenter for Assimilation, the Church Involving and Keeping its Members Manual. He's the co-author of the manual for church planners. Reverend Muller and his wife, Marlene, live here in St. Louis. Let's give Reverend Muller a big round of applause.
Blessed Advent to all of you. This is not normal for churches to be that far removed from the preacher, of course, and it reminds me of a joke I heard Thursday. I was at the board of directors of the Indiana District, and President Sims shared this story of a pastor who wanted to use as his text a theme from Revelation. So he comes into the pulpit with great gusto, raises his arms, says, "Behold, I come." Except this pastor has trouble remembering his sermon text that he's written out. And he doesn't know what comes next, so he steps out of the pulpit, walks around for a moment, thinks he's got it down, comes into the pulpit a second time, "Behold, I come." Still, his mind's a blank, he doesn't know what to say. And the church is filled, there's people in the front pew right down here. So he decides to go back into his little room, except he locked himself out. So he has only one recourse, to come into the pulpit a third and final time, perhaps with a great deal of enthusiasm, and he will remember and begin to start his sermon. He does so, "Behold, I come," but he comes with such gusto that he trips, falls out of the pulpit onto the front pew, breaks the pew, really disturbs a woman in that front pew, and as he gets up, he's very apologetic to this woman and to the congregation, and her reply is, "Well, that's okay, Pastor, you did warn me three times." So we don't have that problem down here this morning. This is the place where I attended chapel at this seminary for many, many years. My class, 61, was the largest in the seminary's history, about 230-some. And we could not get them all in this facility, can you imagine? And there were always people standing on the sides and in the back, and you had to come early to get a seat for chapel. We'll have that day again soon. You should have an outline. If you don't, I assume they're in the back or somewhere. And I've been asked to talk about growth and decline in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Kind of a good news, I guess, bad news. And in this outline, I'm not going to be reading all of this to you, but I thought you would appreciate having some information that you're all dealing with either now or will be in vicarage, in a congregation that you're called to upon graduation, perhaps even in some of the coursework that you are doing. I gather some statistics, although they never present the full picture, they do help us understand some factors. Notice a decline, a 44% decline in the number of member juniors confirmed. And while that's happening in the country, actually, the birth rate has not gone down. It did for a while, but you always have a wider base of families from which children are being produced. So this is not reflecting what's happening with the population of the country. It probably indicates that we are not confirming our children that we baptize, and that's true. We used to confirm about 87 to 90% of the children we baptize. It's now at about 56, 57%. And you will find that the dropout rate most markedly occurs, begins to occur about grade four in our Lutheran congregations. Non-member juniors confirmed also decline in that 20-year period, and we would expect that, you know, same kind of trend to occur there. We really don't do much in the way of child evangelism in a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I find that interesting because we have this fantastic parochial school system with a lot of unchurched children or children from other denominations, and sometimes that's a very vague connection. And we have Sunday schools and VBS and various weekday programs for children. Unlike the evangelicals, who probably emphasize child evangelism primarily in their congregations, 90% of all people become Christians in America before the age of 18, of those who become Christians. And so I think we need to look again at what we're doing in the church with children. It's interesting, you go to pastor's conference and ask a pastor, what size is your congregation? I guarantee you that 8 out of 10 of them will give you the communicant membership. It's as if the children don't count. And you are reminded of the apostles who always wanted to shoo away, you know, the mothers with their children, because in the Jewish mind, they really didn't count until they had their bar mitzvah. Adults confirmed and baptized, that's remained fairly stable over the years, maybe up or down 1,000 a year. I think that's fascinating, that there seems to be that steady, but not growth, and we'd like to see the growth. Reinstatement, now notice that's up for a great deal, and I think there's a reason for that. In October, Alan Kloss was here, and he shared the kind of stuff that we got from Hartford Seminary in the Church Membership Initiative, that there are about 12 million Americans who say they are Lutheran, but only 8 belong to a Lutheran congregation. These other 4 million haven't become Methodist or Presbyterian. They still think of themselves as Lutheran. And so you got a lot of these Lutherans on the loose, I call them, who probably moved out from urban centers or with the mobility. And we have about 14 to 15% of our population moving every year. So that's about 350,000 Missouri Synod Lutherans who move every year, and we're just kind of losing them out the back door. But when we gain them, we can't transfer them often because they've just lost contact with the Lutheran Church. And so that's why I think reinstatements have risen the last years. Notice the number received from other Lutheran bodies. Just make sure you note that because of something that happens later. In the first paragraph, in 92, we had only 69 congregations that confirmed 35 or more adults. You know, that's very, very few. What, 1.2% of our congregations? And I don't think 35 is an especially high number. I don't think so at all. And then look at the rest of the statistics in that paragraph. And so this is a church body where you will find that only about 1 out of 3 congregations have an active outreach program. Only about 20% of them design the things that occur, whether it's the worship or the activities, with the unchurched or the inactive in mind. About 20% basically are saying, we're here, with a focus on those beyond our current membership. Again, that came out of the Church Membership Initiative's work. We grew last year in baptized members, and I think that's a healthy sign. If we can hold on to them, that should mean growth continually in the years to come. But as you see, if we don't hold on to them past grade 4 or 5, then that figure doesn't cause us a great deal of joy. There was a slight decline. The next paragraph, we baptized 2,000 fewer children. Somehow our family ministry has got to become more involved. And again, most congregations don't have a focus on family ministry. They focus on individuals. not families. I think that also tells us that we are a grain denomination. As far as I can tell, we are about 5 years older per member than most Protestant denominations in the United States. It could also mean that our Lutherans are not as prolific as Hispanics or Blacks or Asians, and that's true. That's true. They marry younger than Anglos, and that's what we are primarily in Missouri Synod, and they have more children. So our tragedy is that in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I think we've stayed in the same kind of trends we've seen for a number of years, and we really haven't increased our outreach all that much, and especially to a changing population that is before us. Notice what's happening in Sunday school, and that's happening in all denominations, that Sunday school is less and less a viable means to reach children. And that's why congregations are seeking out other things during the week, and I think we could spend all hour just on this in the area of children. Notice the backdoor losses. Now, according to this, we had a gain of 8,500, 8,588, right, in 92, except you will notice we had a decline of 92 communicants. So why the discrepancy? Well, we have an awful lot of pastors out there who do not take the time to discern or to understand what happens to their membership during the year. They're not even sure. And so they kind of count heads at the end of the year and send that total in. But it doesn't reconcile with the transfers in and out or releases or reinstatements and so on. Now, release from membership, make sure that you all are clear with what that term means. It means that someone is really dropped from membership, one, because they moved and the church just lost track of them, or they joined a non-Lutheran denomination, or they stayed in the area, but they don't want to be a member of any church, especially that Lutheran church, and so they're released from membership. Notice that we lose more members to other Lutheran bodies than we gain from them. The opposite was true in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. I'm not sure, I'm not a good commentator on all of that, but I just know that after our turbulent years began in the 70s, about 20 years ago, that trend was reversed. In the bottom of that page, notice the number of congregations has increased in the Missouri Synod through church planting. Even though we lost 125 congregations in the 70s to then the AELC, we've had church planting. And that's probably one of the things that's helped us a great deal, along with that steady number of adult confirmants. But you again need to remember that 80% of our congregations are either plateauing or declining in membership. Notice the average church attendance. You know what the average church attendance is of Protestant churches in America? Between 75 and 80. And so Elihu Schaller or someone like that, when he looks at the Missouri Synod, thinks of us as a church body of large congregations and large church attendance. Though, you know, you and I may not think that 172 is a real large attendance. Our worship attendance is about 2 percentage points below what it is for the average Protestant church in America. Any questions on any of these items? Okay, I think what we need to do is focus on what I call the three top things that our lay people and pastors tell us they're concerned about in this matter of growth and decline. Every survey says the same thing. All right, let's take a look at how we do outreach today. And I suspect that some changes, though, again, it depends upon the congregation you're from and what your own history is or part of the country and so on. Basically, we see a board in a congregation trying to give that outreach mindset to the whole membership. I think today we don't like to think of just a committee being responsible for evangelism. That's about the best way to come up with plateau or declining congregation. We need to excite the whole membership with the call of our Lord Jesus, the call really of their baptism, to be part of the mission of Jesus Christ in this time and place. Now, the division here of what congregation do is arbitrary. And this is just my observation, what I pick up from the district execs, and which they in turn pick up from the congregation. You will find that first column is what is increasing in the LCMS today. Baptists call that event evangelism. I see a lot of literature today speaking of side door evangelism. That is, that congregations sponsor activities so that the members can meet and interact with the people of the community. You will find that there's a lot of public relations in these things, letting the community know who you are and how you feel about the community, what you would like to offer to them. There's a kind of a marketing that's occurring in a lot of this. If you open a early childhood center or a counseling center in your church, you will probably in your literature or ads target the single parents or people with certain needs in the community. You'll find a lot of that happening in congregations today because there are so many people groups in a community. If you live in a rural area, you probably got somewhere between 7 and 10. Small towns, at least a dozen. Urban, it can be 30 or 40. But just let your eyes look at all of these things and you begin to realize the variety. I just listed those that we see most often in congregations. They can occur on campus or off campus. Doesn't really matter. And I think you're building a relationship through these events. You're informing the community who you are, and again, trying to meet them. A lot of the service, however, occurs in the second column, the group context. And I find there are 6 elements of group ministry in congregations today. One is, you see in Lutheran churches, a lot of use of the word, a lot of Bible study. And that may be different forms, but you'll always find that in some group activity. Even in some of the activities of sports, you'll be surprised how much is happening right now in this country. Prayer. Thirdly, just friendship or fellowship, relationship building. 4, a lot of caring. That we try to be sensitive to the needs of the people in that group, and the group tries to serve together the needs of that individual or that family. A lot of witnessing outreach, that it's easier to bring Henry down the street to your house or to some activity here, a youth group, whatever it may be, than it is maybe for him to walk as a complete stranger into your church. And lastly, assimilation. That this is a way for this person to get involved in something in the congregation where he can use the gifts that God has given to him. The third column reminds us that there are many different types of home visits. I think of this column as an extension of Jesus' ministry. When you look at Jesus' people context in the Gospels, you'll find that at least 3/4 of them are outside of the temple or synagogue. He's going to people where they are, in their homes or in their marketplaces, wherever people live their daily lives. That's where Jesus is spending most of his time. And when a congregation is trying to make that kind of contact out there, some exciting things can happen. Where people are at, most folks will not come to church on their own. Most folks will only come to a church when they have first met someone in that church that they know or can trust, that they can identify with, so that they don't feel like an idiot in their mind when they come for the first time. And I think also in a home visit, there's a lot more sharing that can go on because people bring today a lot of baggage from the past. Past experiences in another church. See, the great majority of our unchurch at one time were in a church, about 80%. And so they've maybe had bad experiences with a pastor or a layperson or some activity, and they're not going to talk about this in the second column, but they will one-on-one or within the confines of their home. In our calling today, we use three key words as we train people: caring, that you listen to those people, what they've gone through; sharing, that you do share the gospel very clearly, very pointedly; and lastly, that you're always preparing them in a call for a Bible class or an adult information class or to come to worship or to be involved in some activity. You're always directing them to something beyond that 30, 40 minute visit. Now, let me tell you a little bit about our country under the third column. When AAL did a church membership initiative, we found out that 89% of our dropout Lutherans have never been visited, 89%. When Gallup does its surveys of all people in America, now this is all people, just about 60% say they've never been visited in their home by someone from a church. And you begin to feel badly then, because you think of all the facilities and the crowded monthly calendars that churches have. But you see, most of that is for the in-group, for the people that are interested, for the people who are concerned. And very little activity is directed toward the inactive who's walking out the back door. And, of course, to those that have already left. Remember I said 87% of all of the unchurched at one time were in a church. The fourth column just reminds us of the ongoing kind of training that's going on in our congregation. The emphasis lately, I say the last 5 years, has been on the first two, spontaneous, you know, across the fence with the neighbor, on the train to work, to the farmer down the road. Just in the course of daily activities, as you get to know people and they begin to surface a doubt or a question or a hurt or a loneliness or a guilt, whatever it may be, that you share, again, your caring, your sharing of the gospel, and trying to direct them to some kind of ministry in the church. A lot of lifestyle stuff. Web is basically our own relationships that already exist. The people who know us and probably will come because they trust us. Someone in the family, or some relative, a friend, coworker, a neighbor, someone I bowl with or play golf with or something like that. And the last one is the ongoing visitation. And I think DE2 and all the students here get exposed to that. You just need to know that's continuing to grow in our Missouri Synod. Okay, I'm going to move on unless there's a question. The number one area that congregations of the LCMS tell us that they want help in is this thing called assimilation. They may call it involving people, both the newcomer as well as the people kind of on the fringe, but I'll call it assimilation. Incorporation is another word that I hear a lot. And you will find that we do have some real assimilation problems. That's why they're saying this. One, you will find that when congregations work hard at getting someone to transfer in or bring them to an adult information class or a reinstatement, those critical times of entry, re-entry, that at the point that person joins and miss congregations, then you're on your own. You're on your own. It's like the pinball machine, you know. That ball makes its entry and bounces around. And if you don't connect to some person or some group, some activity, some role, some task, you're going to go out the back door. We find congregations do very little intentional assimilation, maybe about 10 to 15% of the congregations. Number two, surveys have been taken of thousands of Protestant churches. And we find that in growing churches, about 55 to 60% of the people are involved in some group role, which is kind of an ongoing responsibility, or some task. In plateauing congregations, 40 to 45%, in declining congregations, 25 to 30. And when you see those kind of figures coming back at you, I think we need to sit up and take notice. Backdoor losses we've talked about. the equivalent of a 900-member congregation a week leads Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And all we're saying is that if you don't bring people into the front door meaningfully and intentionally involve them in the life and worship activities of the congregation, the route to the back door is a lot wider and a lot quicker. Number four, I guess we've already pretty well covered that. Don't ignore the children. Interesting, when you go to church and churches around here, you talk to a child on a Sunday morning, you will find that very few adults ever talk to a child. Interesting. We talk to adults. Number five, we talked about worship attendance. But remember, a lot of those are repeaters who are there 3 and 4 Sundays a month. That means the great majority of our people are really seldom in church. Monitoring. Would you like to take a survey and just go into a congregation you're vicarying and ask the fifth grade Sunday school teacher, do you know who the fifth grade children are that should be coming to Sunday school? Very seldom do they know. Congregations don't even know who their baptized communicant membership is. One of the big complaints when I was mission evangelism exec in Northern Illinois is that during the vacancy, the lay people wanted to get some handle on what this congregation is, and they didn't know. There weren't any records. The new pastor coming in, finding there weren't good records of monitoring the church, or what happens to the people once they come into the church. And it's interesting, if you join a church, don't you want to know that somebody takes an interest in you? That someone will speak to you and ask you how things are going and ask you to be involved in something. And if you say yes, that maybe they'll help you so you don't look like a dummy. And as time goes on, maybe commend you, pat you on the back. Don't you want that as a human being? And yet you see that's not happening in a lot of our congregation. In the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, depending upon the congregation, 1/3 to 1/2 of the people feel they have joined the church but don't feel a part of the congregation. We have some survey instruments that we use now in the LCMS that congregations have, and we have a manual that we have prepared on assimilation, the church involving and keeping its members. And you can get that from CPH, but I think it's marvelous because of all the instruments that we've gotten from congregations, and you need to know it's from them. So there's about 20 major indicators that let you know whether you're paying attention to your people or not. We often spend time also with Acts 14 as we go out to congregations, and this is just an example of where the apostle didn't just win, but they go back to these people. There was some kind of soul accounting, some monitoring, and they strengthen those people with all those pagan temples around them, a lot of personal encouragement, a structure, a process in place of appointing people who would minister to those who came into the church. And notice a spiritual life that went along with that. I wonder how many of our people who joined the church have a group praying for them today. It's just a reminder that we don't know much about structure and congregational activity in the book of Acts, but this is one glimpse that there was a lot of what we would call assimilation in those congregations. Moving on down the outline, we have also discovered that those people who feel they are part of the church before they join are the ones most likely to stay. Now, that's kind of profound, because traditionally we just say, well, get your transfer in or come to adult instruction class, and then we started maybe paying attention to them and asking them to be involved in something. What we've discovered from our congregations again and again, that if people are not involved at the time they join, you got about 6 to 9 months to get them involved in some activity, or they're already walking out the back door. And what you do before they join will just help you in those 6 to 9 months. So check out before people join, as you visit them, say their first worship service and so on, what their needs and expectations are. Don't just make a visit and speak at them for 30 minutes, dumping on them all your brochures and packet of things, which, you know, I know we sometimes have done in the church. But ask what they've experienced, where they've been in churches. Did they appreciate that? What would you like for yourself and for your family, for your spiritual life today? What are you looking for so that you understand maybe we're dealing with some real tough issues that are in that congregation? I shall never forget that in my previous congregation where I belong, kind of an inactive member because I was always preaching somewhere on a Sunday, my wife and I were sponsors for five families. And we called on this one family, I think it was about the third time, and after about an hour, the man just began to show anger. He was inactive. And he had had a bad experience in some congregation downstate. And then he just vented his anger of all that happened. And the wife is crying. And we just, let it flow. It came up. And I asked him, why haven't you shared this before? And he said, nobody ever asked me how I felt about the church. Not too long ago up in Michigan, I had a layman come up to me and say, I just went through a 3-session called orientation in my church. You need to know, Lyle, that staff talked at us for 3 weeks, and I never said a word. Interesting, isn't it? That can happen. You believe so strongly in your church and in your programs, and you almost are like a salesman selling this to the new person, and we're not finding out where they're at and maybe what's happened in their past. And an awful lot of people have got hurt and loneliness or guilt, sadness, conflict in their lives. One of the things that John Savage, leadership, education, development writer, says is that 42% of our people have had conflict with the pastor sometime in their past. 36% have had conflict with another member. And about 25% have had conflict with someone in their family. And the average person never resolves his conflict. He just walks away from the person he's had conflict with. And so we need to be open to that. Now let's talk about what it means to be an open or closed church. One of the writers in this whole area, Celia Hahn from the Elbin Institute out on the East Coast, has written some excellent stuff in this area. An open church is where the movement is always in and out, in terms of the activity of the individual Christian coming in to worship, to be strengthened, to experience warm, caring community of Christians who care about me and love me, accept me, make me feel like I belong. And secondly, relate my daily existence to God's Word. So we come, but we also leave those sanctuary doors knowing that this has only been a part of my spiritual life. And so the biblical pictures of body, vine, and branches, an equipping, training place, come alive in open churches. And serving Christ and serving each other, serving the community is what's talked about, not belonging as such, although the word may be there. And the objects of ministry are primarily the people in the community. She uses the expression, when the salt of the earth is stuck to the salt cellar, we're all in trouble. And I'm sure you see what she means. That again, most of our religious energies and efforts are spent with the saved, inside the salt cellar. In the closed church, everything is spoken of as an institution. A lot of emphasis upon structure, authority, budgets, agendas. It's those things that are emphasized the most. You're a faithful member when you financially support the congregation and attend all things. The action is in the building, not out there. It's within the facility. And therefore, most of the style, whether it's worship or programs, activities, is fairly rigid, closed. Who's the expert in a closed church? The pastor. And he better function as an expert. And you will find then our burnout of pastors occur primarily in these type of congregations, because no pastor can live up to all those expectations that are heaped upon him today, increasingly by lay people, if he's expected to know everything and to do most of the thing. In closed churches, the clergy tend to overfunction and the laity tend to underfunction. And so we have a checklist of about 35 items in our manual of to check yourself out. How do you appear to people who worship at your place the first time? It was interesting, on Monday I spoke at the St. Charles in Wentzville Pastoral Conference, and they wanted me to help them write a mission statement as a congregation. And I started out by saying, all of you have gone to Cardinal baseball. Cardinals have a theme. You hear it from Jack Buck again. Bring the whole family out to the ballpark and have a good time. You will hear that many times. And I said, why don't you jot down all the things they do to carry out that vision of who they are? Well, they came up with 19, and finally I cut off the discussion. And you begin to realize all the specific things that management or leadership does. Now I said, now if I visited your church, whether it was worship or group life, something during the week, what would I encounter? What would I observe about you? What are you showing to me and telling me? And that's the kind of thing that we do in a checklist. Your worship bulletins. Do you have a visitor center? How do you greet? You know, the mechanical arm at the door that greets people, not very effective. There's at least 5-6 other things that have to be done. That's the kind of thing that we talk about then in assimilation workshops. We've also learned that that initial visit has to be made very soon after they visit or worship with us, definitely within about a day and a half to 2 days. And it's extremely important to listen, to cover about 3 things. One, I'm glad, we're glad that you were there. Secondly, ask, you know, do you have some questions about what you read or saw, what you experienced, how you felt about it? You know, really dialogue heavily on that. And thirdly, just say, may we have your permission to come back or to invite you to certain things or put you on the mailing list, whatever it is that your church does. But always, whenever you complete any visit, by the way, in evangelism, there must always be an indicator of what follows the visit. They must mutually own that decision with you. You never send something if they didn't ask for it. You don't send a person or a bulletin or a newsletter unless they want it. They need to have ownership in that kind of follow-up thing. And then the in-depth visit, again, at their choice, at their pace, at their time. It may be a month. You will find, unfortunately, that people shop around today much longer. The average time is 6 to 8 months before people will pick a church. Orientation is a session, usually sessions of about 3 to 4 hours, I find the average, more than one time, in which a congregation shares who they are, what they're about. There's usually 5 goals that I find most common in orientation sessions. One, it's a form to talk about what Christian discipleship is. Secondly, to develop a relationship. They can meet other people, and that's why you never want to just meet with one family at a time, though there are one-on-one forums that occur. Thirdly, share some information. I see video being used increasingly here. Fourthly, introduce them to key leaders of the congregation. So they recognize a few faces and names and put that together with the leadership role they have. And lastly, start a process by which they can select their functions in the church, whether it's a group, a role, or a task. I think that the reception of new members has to be highlighted much more. I've noticed that some congregations, it's just a little note in the bulletin, bottom of the third page. Next to your festivals, make the reception of new members the most exciting thing in the church, and really celebrate. And have a receiving line for the whole congregation to meet these new people. And make sure you introduce the whole family to the congregation. And have a little, if it's just coffee and cake, reception between services or after that service. But make a big thing out of it, because it is. If just one comes back, it's interesting in the Gospels, there are only two times when you see the angels in heaven rejoicing there over something that happens on earth. What are the two times? Jesus' birth and when one person returns to God. Just one. All of heaven breaks out in celebration. And we put it on the bottom of the third page, you know, of the newsletter. And most people never meet this individual and get a chance to pump their hand and to have a good time with them. And then we have lots of suggestions in these assimilation workshops about how they can maintain. The next subject there is the one that's most difficult, and so we spent a lot of time on that today in the church. How do you motivate, recruit? Turn to the next page. We have to give a lot of instruments and helps to congregations to do that, to develop a profile of the people and how to contact them, involve them in the future. Really, in an assimilation, responsibility is to play the role of matchmaker, of matching people with a role, which would be like a choir member or on a board or committee, or a task. It might be that we are going to do the shrubbery, paint a room, set up a computer program for a few nights at the church. Those would be like tasks. And then, of course, groups, there's many kinds of groups, Bible study groups, prayer groups, support groups, fellowship groups, social type groups, fellowship group, task-oriented group, house church groups. I mean, just go on and on and on. They all have those common characteristics I talked about earlier, but one thing is always emphasized. You read the book of Acts, and you will find small group life very pronounced. And I think it's because spiritual growth can occur more there. You know, a person can come to church. You don't have to open a book. You don't have to talk to a soul. Leave after an hour and go to your car and go home. You can't do that in group life. And also, I think there's a lot of leadership development that occurs, a lot of spiritual development, a lot of relationship building. And we have found a lot of growth in numbers. About 60% now of all new churches planted in the Missouri Synod are through groups. Let's turn to the next page. By the way, staffing, you just need to know that the trend in our growing churches is not to call additional called workers or professional church workers, but to raise up people out of the congregation who would give you 10, 20 hours a week. They can specialize, you can train them, find the training for them. There's less competition, there's not the trauma of a move for the family. I hate to say it, but it's a lot cheaper. But you take one professional church worker that gives you 60 hours as an assistant pastor, and replace that person with three people who give you each 20 hours, you will get much more from those three people. And I think lastly, and I'm sure you understand what I'm saying, is that most of us at the seminary were not trained to be specialists. And sometimes we find it difficult, having been trained to be a generalist, now to just work in a specialist role in a congregation. There's rare birds who can do it, but there's not many who can do it. Next page. I think I've covered a lot of this first page already. In our own, looking under A, our own CMI study indicated that the people who left the Missouri Synod did so for about four or five reasons. Let me see if I have my sheet here. And, yes, I do. And just think of people you know who have left the church. These are the major reasons. They moved. By the way, 50% of all Lutherans who move never request a transfer. Secondly, felt they were being judged inappropriately or negatively in times of personal or family difficulty. In other words, they had a problem, no one helped them, in fact, judged them. Thirdly, they found other interests more compelling, and anyone born after 1945, you'll find that more common. They felt the congregation did not provide in-depth Bible preaching and teaching related to personal daily life issues. That's fascinating to me. See, they reflect their Lutheran background where the preaching and teaching of the word is important, but they're saying, when you did it, you didn't relate it to my daily life, to my personal daily life issues. And lastly, they felt time was not available. Isn't that interesting and discouraging? Wynn Arnn came up with a fourfold definition, and that's very helpful, by the way, not to just think of active, inactive, but he says the active are those, again, involved in worship and in your group roles and tasks. Non-active, I would call non-participating, are those people who come only to worship, but you can't call them inactive. And you got to be very careful how you refer to them publicly in your congregation. They're in worship, but they don't participate in anything else. And that's not just older people, by the way. Inactive would be those who probably worship about 1 to 4 or 5 times a year, are not involved in anything. The dropout is a big fat zero on everything. And yet, for some reason, that congregation keeps them on the roster. But in their minds and hearts, they've dropped out. They've dropped out. J. Russell Hale has done a lot of work on the unchurched, who they are and why they stay away, tells us of that growing lack of loyalty or decline of loyalty to institutions. They're very disenchanted with clergy power. If you use control language as a pastor, they're out of there. They don't trust institutional structures, whether it's government or anything else. Vietnam and Watergate, you know, helped to take care of a lot of that. They dislike any true church mentality. Boxed in, a lot of people that come out of Roman Catholic and Pentecostal background feel that way. Any smothering rules and regulations, any kind of narrow doctrines. Burned out, that's the retiree, except he can be 30 years old, from church, who felt he was manipulated or used. Burned out. By the way, children of burned out people also become inactive. Next page. The floaters are simply those people. They move into town. They know when they're going to move out already. You know, 18 months, my company's going to ship me out. So they just kind of float around. No roots, hedonists. The circuits are jammed. And I've got to get away. You know, I've got to do this. Camping or fishing or whatever it is. And that's become an obsession with these folks, their pleasure in those things. Locked out, the poor, the handicapped. Only about 10% of the deaf in America and blind go to church, for instance. Elderly, the sick, people of a different lifestyle, nomads. There are just folks who wander around, and every so often, they just got to get up and move to another church. They will only stay so long. You will find a large number of those people. It's like they graduate from a church, time to move on to another church. The pilgrim, or another word is used a lot, is a seeker today, an inner restlessness. They're asking some very tough questions. They don't feel they're getting the answers, but they are asking. They're very honest about that. The publican is the person who's had a bad experience sometime in the past, usually with the clergy, though not only them. And they feel the clergy and these lay leaders are hypocrites for judging them, because I know what those people really are like. You can just hear people say that. And about 8 to 10% of the population say they have no faith in God at all. David Rusin, just spent some time with him in October from Hartford. Jackson Carroll speak of that rates of disengagement. There's a lot of study going on in our country now about that. Remember I said the fourth grade is when our Lutherans most markedly begin to drop out. It continues. The most unchurched age among Lutherans is age 27. Dean Hoag looked at a lot of national factors, Roman Catholic scholar, the growing individualism in our country, this quest for personal freedom. I don't want to subscribe to something that may control me or rule me. And Americans tolerate diversity of belief and lifestyle. It's interesting, isn't it, how our Supreme Court and one municipality after another has to deal with that issue. Incredible how much in the forefront it is in our country today. Princeton Religion Research Center, or Gallup, the religious arm of the Gallup organization, reminds us that the attitudes in America are basically congregations are concerned with organization more than with people. Basically, they are unfriendly. Basically, they disregard the needs and hurts, problems of people, society, and they don't find people to help you when you have those needs. And lastly, they think the attitude is that the church is still a political or power institution with power and authority resting in the hands of a few. And then the discretionary, as far as it triggers, their time they feel is less, the discretionary time. That's when I take on a new job or new responsibilities, or as my family grows, that's a good time to leave the church. When I moved, if I have a crisis in my family, a job loss, death in the family, serious illness, if I leave home, that's a time of transition in my life, and so on. John Savage speaks of anxiety-producing events, four types for inactives, and I think that's probably most helpful for you if you can get a hold of his stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's rooted in reality. Someone said you were a lousy Sunday school teacher, or you worked on the roof job of the church and it didn't turn out well, and someone publicly criticized you in a voters' assembly, or the pastor got involved in some scandal. We just know in districts that if we have a problem with a pastor's personal life, that at least 10% of the membership in that congregation are going to leave. Secondly, neurotic. The women and the ladies' aid are always talking about me. I was in a hospital and nobody came to see me, and I know pastor doesn't like me. We all have a little neuroses in us, so we can understand these things. Behavior, there are some things that just happen in a person's life. They get involved in a lifestyle. And so there's a great contradiction between God's word and that lifestyle. And they become increasingly uncomfortable. And lastly, to me, that was always the hardest as a pastor to deal with, the existential factor, where people begin to feel that life is dealing them one tough blow after another. And they're just kind of throwing a towel in on everything. Nothing really makes sense anymore. And people who go through those times of crises, remember earlier, you can understand why they leave. Marks of the baby boomers, and really the busters as well, a lower commitment to the church than their parents, less time in their minds that they want to give for any cause like this. If it is involvement short term, boomers and busters don't like 2 and 3 year terms of office. And I tell pastors, if you need to have that yet, then you need to have at least many more tasks. If you've got 80 positions that are filled by election or appointment, you better have 300 tasks available, because people don't want to stay on a board or a committee for 2 and 3 years like they used to. They're highly materialistic and desire excellence in worship, in the graphics you use as you print things, your appointments in your churches, the kind of music you have. People don't put up with the mediocre as they used to. And one of the reasons why big churches are growing more in America is not because they're large, but because there tends to be higher standards of performance and more choices open to people from which to choose, again, to meet their personal and family lives. And the last mark of the baby boomer buster is they want individual recognition more. That's part of that individualism we talked about earlier. Friendship factor for inactives. We found that inactives know only two people well on the average in church. Inactives know somewhere between 30 and 40. Family factor. Greeley, from the Roman Catholic Church, has probably done the most study on this, that where there is intimacy and good support in the family, then the couples, both of them, stay in the church longer. And where both parents go to church, the children will stay in the church much longer, and so on. The assimilation factor we talked about earlier and the staffing. Incidentally, Lyle Schaller says, the two churches are the most understaffed, the Roman Catholic and the Lutheran. Well, we got to wrap this up. All we do in the rest of this, then, in our workshops is help the members look at the inactives in their congregations. We give them approaches of how they can make contact from telecare to a shepherd program, Stephen ministry, small group ministry, gatekeeper, all that kind of thing. We go through the biblical principles, the next page. Spend a lot of time in Bible study, about a third of the time in our ministry to inactives workshops in Synod are spent on that page. The manual is about 60 pages. I'm just giving you a little overview. And then we talk about the visiting. Jim, I tried to outline what I see to be the three major factors of growth and decline. Variety today of outreach methods, strong assimilation, and ministry to inactives. And growing congregations are doing them. It's fun for me going out there and doing workshops because I learn the most. Yeah, I get all that feedback and I can share that in the next workshop. As of January 1st, I leave evangelism. I've accepted the call to head up congregational services for Synod. I have some misgivings about that because I have liked what I've done. But now we will try to bring youth and evangelism and worship and stewardship and education and leadership development and family ministry together and help them interrelate more. So maybe I can bring evangelism to bear on more areas than I have in the past. I really consider it an honor to be here. I have enjoyed this.
Give him a round of applause.